This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk with the Aviation Program Coordinator for the University of Maine, Augusta. In the news, we look at the stolen and crashed Horizon Air turboprop, the proposed British jet fighter, the effect of elevated carbon monoxide levels in the flight deck, the percentage of women pilots, and a lawsuit over lavatory access. Also, the fatal JU-52 crash, and a pancake breakfast and fly-in. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 516 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is David Vanderhoof. He's our aviation historian. He blogs at whatjustflewby.com. Hi, David.
Hi, everybody. If you need me, I will be drowning, considering we are having floods for the last couple of days. So anybody have an ark nearby, let me know, or a helicopter to come pick me up. But looking forward to a good show tonight.
Great. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's the 2008 CFI of the year, and he's our resident Cirrus aircraft expert. Hey, Max.
And my new title is going to become Smoke Jumper. We seem to have a lot of smoke around these parts here. A week ago, it was about 3 miles or less in smoke. Today was better, but just depends on which way the wind's blowing as to whether we can see around here.
They say that some of your smoke has blown all the way across to our coast.
I heard that.
Yeah, that's rather incredible.
You know, Max is always blowing smoke to our coast.
That was too easy, huh? And that, of course, is the voice of our main man, Micah. Micah, welcome to the show.
Hey, everyone. Great to be here. And here I am in a very, very foggy Portland.
Micah, what's better than one guy from Maine?
Must be two guys from Maine.
Two guys from Maine. That's right. Our guest this episode is Greg Jolda. He's the Aviation Program Coordinator, also lecturer in Computer Information Systems at the University of Maine at Augusta. Now, Greg has an Air Force background, a United States Air Force pilot. He retired as Lieutenant Colonel and Command Pilot with over 3,000 hours in four operational aircraft, including over 1,000 hours as instructor pilot. Greg flew the T-33 and instructed on the T-37. He was a C-130 commander and air operations officer, that in Japan, and instructor pilot and flight commander on the T-38. In addition, Greg taught electrical engineering and computer science at the United States Military Academy, West Point. Now, Greg earned his Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering from Northeastern University in Boston and a MS, a Master's in Electrical Engineering, from the Air Force Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton. Greg, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you, Max. I almost didn't recognize that fellow.
Yeah, when you add all those things up, boy, that's pretty impressive. But not only that, Greg is a Cirrus Standardized Instructor Pilot, a CSIP. Greg, that means that we have two CSIPs on the show this episode.
I know, and I am excited to learn of Max's venture. But I did want to say that the foggy Portland provided some great instrument flying this morning into Portland and back into Brunswick. So I do thank the weather for that. It was very nice, very nice flying in there.
Very good.
In the Cirrus, actually.
Oh, in the Cirrus.
Yes.
I got to thank Greg for upping the numbers here. So the electrical engineers on the show now outnumber the other engineers on the show today. So.
Oh, that's right. Two electrical engineers, two double E's and two C-SIPs. That's pretty impressive.
That's what it takes to fly a Cirrus. You need a double E these days.
Oh, yeah.
It does, really.
All right. Well, we're going to talk to Greg about, the program at the University of Maine, also about his flying career, being a C-SIP, and a couple of other things lined up. But first, we've got some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the west.
Ready up here.
Drowning in the east.
All right. Well, we'll start off with the item that's probably most prominent in the news right now. We have a number of different articles that we've been referencing from the BBC, from the Seattle Times, a few others. And, of course, this is about the Horizon Air Bombardier Q400 turboprop that was stolen by an airline employee at Seattle's SeaTac International Airport. He made an unauthorized takeoff. The plane was empty, at least as far as we know at this point. This plane was a Horizon plane. Of course, Horizon is a subsidiary of Alaska Air Group. And he made a little flight, maybe about an hour or so, maybe a little bit longer, performed some aerobatic maneuvers. He was chased by a couple of Air National Guard F-15Cs and ultimately crashed on Keetron Island in Puget Sound. This story has got just so many interesting, well, strange, bizarre aspects to it, not the least of which is aerobatic maneuvers in a Q400 turboprop. That's something you don't see very often, particularly for a guy who's not, I guess, not a pilot. Max Trescott, you think it's surprising that someone would just sort of limited knowledge. I guess he told air traffic control he had some experience playing computer simulations, but to be able to do what he did, I don't know. Is it as crazy as it sounds?
Yeah, I think it is as crazy as it sounds. I mean, there are a whole lot of angles you could look at this. I mean, when the guy said that he had a screw loose and he just realized it the first time, I'm thinking maybe someone had an inkling beforehand that maybe he had a screw loose. I think the challenge is in identifying folks who are going to do crazy things is that if you were to try and screen out all of the people who you know, might meet some criteria, we'd be getting rid of half the pilots and half the airline employees, all to try and prevent a one in a million type thing like this. So I think the natural reaction is going to be to try and crank up security for airport workers. I'm just not sure that we'll ever be able to completely eliminate these kinds of things. But yeah, I think it probably is credible that he could learn enough through a simulator and through things he might have found online about how to use the throttles and stuff like that. I mean, certainly in his job, he probably knew how to start the airplane anyway, since they taxi planes around using ground crew.
Yeah, all the notes that I've read about it, all the news stories said that, in his position, that he would be very, very aware of how to start it and how to move it along and do things. In fact, David pointed out to me that he took the tractor himself and backed it away so he could taxi it out himself. So he obviously had a lot of knowledge. Although Captain Rick, who used to fly the Q400 before he moved over to the E-170s and E-175, said trying to start that was a real bear, and even he would have trouble trying to start up his Q400s, and he was flying them.
Well, it's interesting. He picked an airplane that has a built-in air stair, which most don't. So, I mean, he picked the one airplane where he didn't have to be using a ladder or going to a jetway to get inside. So I think he must have thought about this a little bit beforehand.
Now, on these F-15s, interestingly enough, our friend Isaac, who not only saw the turboprop fly over his house, but he also heard the sonic booms as the F-15s cut in their afterburners, I guess, to pursue this aircraft. But David, when we see these kinds of things, or when we see an aircraft that's kind of in an unexpected situation, it seems like the fighter jets show up really, really fast.
Considering they were from another state, yes. There is no interceptor squadrons in the state of Washington. Those were from Portland, Oregon, believe it or not. And Oregon has the fighter wing there that has at least three aircraft always on alert for precisely this. We didn't know exactly what the intentions were of this pilot. And since 9/11, we have aircraft on alert duty. And basically, they are fully armed, fully fueled, ready to take off in a moment's notice aircraft like we did back in the Cold War. In this case, we launched two F-15s, and Red 41 and 42 immediately got clearance to go supersonic, and were, if you listen to The Drive by Tyler Ridgway, he's got the whole 16-minute incident on recording. And basically, the aircraft took off, pilots got in them, took off, and they went straight for the target. SeaTac control vectored them in, And normally what the intention would be to get up close and get the pilot's attention. One aircraft, the lead aircraft, was coming up behind it and trying to get the pilot's attention, while the other one was back and higher at the wingman in case of an emergency or something like that. Unfortunately, by the time they were following him around and he did the barrel roll, he had made the decision that it was time to call it a day, as he said. But yeah, I mean, they were in a position to, they were fully armed. While they didn't fire on anything, they had the ability to, should something have happened, shoot down the aircraft.
Greg, what do you think might have been going through the minds of those Air Force pilots? I mean, we hear from the air traffic control recording the usual calmness in the voice of the controller. But the F-15 pilots, I mean, these are the guys that that are armed and may have to shoot down an airplane in a situation like this. What do you think is going through their minds at that time?
It's all mission and it's all training. That's part of the training after pilot training for the fighter lean in and the fighter grade upgrade and the prep, and it's a mission brief and you just go and do the job. It's like the Navy pilot, the ex-Navy pilot that brought in the Southwest airplane too. It's all calm and it's training and it's training and training and training, and the confidence that's there. And I hate to say it's routine, but it's the training that just pulls right in.
Well, that makes sense. And I think that also explains why the air traffic controllers are most of the time extremely calm, even in situations where us mere mortals might be, having difficulty keeping it together.
David, did you hear anything about, I knew that the F-15s topped off from a KC-135, but I also had read that there was a KC-46 up and actually offered to top them off, that they didn't need it. I was just surprised that, there was a KC-46 flying that would have had enough gas to be able to do that, as it hasn't been in service. Did you hear anything about that or have any comments about that?
There was actually a pair of them. They were on Boeing test flights. And in the middle of the incident, they were doing basically air-to-air refueling themselves. Now, what would have made that very challenging is neither of the F-15 pilots nor probably the boom operators were really prepared to do what they were asking and offering to do. The tanker out of Fairchild actually made it in time, but pilots do whatever they need to do. And a lot of times the tanker guys will go out of their way to save the fighter jocks. So it was an interesting profile that these two KC-46s were like, well, we've got gas and we've got a boom. So if they need it, they can come to us. So it's another sort of kind of weird aspect of this whole event was we could have had the first operational air-to-air refueling by a Pegasus KC-46, but that didn't happen. The good old 135 from Fairchild showed up, and the guys got their gas and went back to Portland.
Now, thanks for the explanation on that. I had heard the fighter pilots at one point when they were in the ATC had referred to a Boeing tanker over the field, and I think he said it's not ours or something like that. So that explains that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they didn't. Needless to say, flying a tanker, especially one you've never flown with, is and especially something as new as a KC-46. They're not operationally certified yet, so it would have been a very dramatic event had it happened. But, when you've got bingo fuel, you got to get, it's either that or land, and basically the whole airspace was shut down. So,
yeah,
the other part of the recording you get to hear is you get to hear the lead F-15 pilot talk about the airspace over the crash site where they were still patrolling for a little bit while while a rescue helicopter and some other people arrived. So their mission wasn't over immediately after the impact with the ground for the Q400.
Well, our friend Todd Curtis from airsafe.com was interviewed by BBC 5 Live Radio about this crash. And of course, Todd is one of those people who, when there is an accident like this, he has the facts and none of the speculation that so many news outlets are, you know, prone to dispensing. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes to his interview. But I thought it was kind of interesting because one line of questioning that came from the BBC to him was this notion of you have locks on your car. Don't we have locks on airplanes? Can people just walk into an airplane? And Todd made the point that, well, it's a little bit different situation because, you know, in your automobile, your personal automobile, you know, the security is the automobile associated with the automobile. Whereas at an airport, the security is not centered around specific airplanes, but it's the airport itself that represents the secure zone. And that, you know, this was an incident that really may have been just a one-off kind of a thing or a very, very unlikely kind of an incident. But it's interesting to think about whether or not there will be some security changes applied to airports in general, maybe as a result of this. I'm kind of inclined to think that there doesn't really seem to be something that you need to do. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Is there, Greg, do you think there's, you know, something that needs to happen at airports that hasn't been happening in the past?
You know, I, as you were discussing that, I ran that thought through my mind and know the pilot training issues. The T-37s were all unlocked. You could start that. They were electric. The T-38, you needed someone to help you because of the Palouste. The C-130, you could start. Someone needed to start the APU. So you could probably get away, you know, with it, but I don't know how you would separate this an isolated incident like this.
There was another point, I think, when Todd was talking about, you know, he was asking, you know, why they have keys for houses and cars, but not for airplanes. And I was thinking it was a perfect opportunity to tell him that houses and cars are really secured by a key for access by one or two people. You know, if you had an airliner, imagine all the different people who need access to that aircraft and what's going to be like when we're ready to, you know, launch a flight to Atlanta and they come on the intercom and say, well, we'll be ready to go as soon as we find the key to the airplane.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is a developing story. We haven't touched on all aspects of it, but it's, as I say, it's developing. So I think more facts will come out, more information will come out. I have read that the SeaTac airport officials are already talking about having conversations surrounding the security aspects of this. And that'll be interesting to watch to see if they come up with something or if they also conclude that what's in place is sufficient.
Hey, there's a related story I just wanted to mention. I don't know if you guys caught this. There was another aircraft stolen very early on Monday morning, so less than 60 hours after this aircraft was stolen. There was a Citation jet stolen out of Utah. Apparently, a pilot, 47 years old, had been arrested the prior evening for domestic violence. He was released on bail. Went in, according to the article, secured some things at his house. I'm not sure what that meant. Went off to the airport, stole this Citation jet, and flew it into his house at 2:30 in the morning, which is quite a trek. I don't know how you managed to hit a particular house in the dark. That's pretty remarkable in itself. And his wife and son were in the house, and they were uninjured. So, I mean, here we've had two stolen aircraft, two very clearly, you know, mentally agitated people involved. Just very odd. I don't remember ever in history having, you know, two kind of mental cases like this in such a short period. In fact, it almost made me wonder if one inspired the other to some extent.
Yeah, copycat kind of event. That would be terrible. Yeah. And I understand that that pilot that you mentioned was killed when he crashed into his own house.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was interesting when you look at the crash photos. The plane seemed to be pretty much obliterated in the front of the house. You could see the tail, but it didn't look like it did, you know, that it penetrated the house to a large degree. Clearly, the front of the house was burned, but it was still standing.
Hmm. All right. Well, why don't we move on and look at a story in Wired.com. This is Meet the UK's New Very British Fighter Jet. Now, at Farnborough this year, there was a full-scale model of this UK Tempest fighter that was displayed. They're calling it a sixth-generation fighter. It's a little reminiscent of the F-22 in terms of exterior sort of configuration, two engines, twin vertical stabilizers, and it kind of has that stealthy sort of shape to it. David, what can you tell us about the plan for this this Tempest fighter?
It's vaporware.
Yeah.
Great Britain has got a little bit of a problem. Over the years, since the late 60s, they have worked collaboratively with European nations. The Jaguar was with France. The Eurofighter was with Germany and Italy. Well, we have this thing called Brexit that's coming. And they're going to have to figure out a way of supporting their military for the replacement for their Eurofighters. Now that the Tonkas are gone, the Tornadoes, and the newest aircraft they have, of course, are the Lightning IIs, but they are the B version, so the vertical takeoff and landing. They don't have an interceptor fighter bomber per se, which is where this aircraft would come through. But we know the challenges of creating sixth generation aircraft, and this is one of those ones where does Great Britain have the will to go it alone? Do they have the money to go it alone? And so it's going to be interesting to see. Of course, the Tempest was a late World War II, post-World War II fighter by Hawker. So it's like everything else. Everybody has expectations, but, you know, it takes a lot to build an airplane. Just look at what it takes to build an airliner, a modern fighter jet. I mean, how many years have we been waiting for the F-35 to get into production? So this is, and that's a multi-nation project, you know, a Great Britain going alone on a project. I don't know if the British government and the Ministry of Defense has the budget or the stomach to support that kind of project.
Well, according to the Wired article, the UK Ministry of Defense plans to spend $2.6 billion US to develop the plane through 2025 and then make a decision whether to proceed or not with a rollout in 2035. So, yeah, this is pretty far into the future if it does happen.
David, can you explain what makes it a sixth generation, what the changes are from fifth to sixth generation might be considered?
Integrated electronics, Super Cruise, stealth. Normally, the sixth generation aircraft have internal weapons bays and are sensor platforms like the F-35 and the F-22. Part of their lethality is their ability to not be seen, but to be able to also detect everybody else's aircraft. So, and of course, super maneuverability in the case of the F-22 or the Soviet ones or the Chinese aircraft. So those are all aspects of what makes a sixth-generation fighter. And then you get things like F-15s, which are fourth generation plus, and it's kind of a loose term anymore. You know, aircraft change over time, but the F-22 and the new Sukhoi pack are considered sixth generation fighters, and the United States Air Force, of course, is starting to work on quote a seventh generation air dominance fighter. So.
Because six isn't good enough, right?
Well, it's the military. It's never good enough.
Yeah, yeah.
When your enemies start catching up, you need to move the bar again.
You got to go to 11.
Or something different. And coincidentally, I was listening to a recent edition of Aviation Week's Check 6 podcast. This one, it's titled DARPA's Space Shakeup. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. But they had a conversation with Fred Kennedy, who's the director of DARPA's Tactical Technology Office. And one of the things he was talking about when they were discussing, you know, stealth and where that was going, he made the point that, you know, our adversaries have had 40 years or some amount of time to catch up on stealth. And so the question is, what's the next thing that we do? And he's suggesting that it may not be better stealth. It may be a completely different kind of an approach. Like maybe instead of trying to construct a relatively small number of relatively large unobservable aircraft, maybe you go in the opposite direction and say, they're going to be observable aircraft. Everybody's going to be able to see them, but we're going to have lots and lots and lots of them that are very small. And so the advantage is in the numbers. You know, your adversary can't take out huge numbers of relatively small aircraft. And so I thought that was very interesting. And it made me wonder, when thinking about this Tempest, is that, you know, is better stealth really, you know, the best end game at this point in the history of, you know, of air warfare?
Kind of like going with a MIRV warhead so that you have multiple independent reentry vehicles as opposed to one big one. The other thing that comes to mind is, was it Khrushchev that said, quantity has a quality all its own?
And I'm surprised, Max, that you didn't say, Ian, we could have a swarm of drones, which would fulfill that, that need.
I know. Yeah, we have another podcast for that one, don't we? All right, pushing on from Bloomberg. Stale cockpit air may be dulling your airline pilot's performance. Interesting. Max T., this is coming about from a new Harvard University study, I guess.
Yeah, I was kind of intrigued to see this. Basically, they say that normal levels of carbon dioxide are 400 parts per million in the atmosphere, and that the European Aviation Safety Agency found that on 5% of airline flights, the carbon dioxide levels are as high as 1,400 parts per million. So what, about 3.5 times higher than that? And there was a simulator study that was done just to see, hey, how does increasing levels of carbon dioxide affect people? And so they did a test where they set the simulator to 700 parts per million. I was going to say that's some simulator where you can dial in the carbon dioxide content. But they said at that level, pilots were 69% more likely to correctly perform the maneuvers compared to when they were breathing carbon monoxide at 2,500 parts per million. And they said at 1,500 parts per million, they are 52% more likely to pass. So it just raises a really interesting question. I know we've talked about air quality in airliners, you know, for passengers. I don't think we've ever talked, or I don't recall ever seeing a study that said, you know, at some point you could have air that's so bad that the pilots are going to be making poor decisions. Now, they did say that there have been no known crashes due to poor air in the cockpit, but it's, you know, certainly an interesting consideration.
Sort of reminds you of a scene in Apollo 13, doesn't it? With the carbon dioxide scrubbers?
Yes.
Greg, do you think that this is an issue, if it is an issue, that might be different in commercial aircraft versus military aircraft versus GA aircraft? I mean, I have in my head this vision of sort of this, you know, sort of leaky kind of aircraft where the CO2 levels may not be an issue. Is that an uninformed kind of a viewpoint?
I don't know. I ran through the planes, sometimes in the Cessnas and the beaches that I fly, I wonder really what I am breathing. Then you go to the Cirrus, that's a little bit easier to tell. It seems to be pretty clean. And then thinking about the comment about the simulator, you know, the 130 simulators all had the air vents in, so it'd be pretty easy to dial in some carbon dioxide if you wanted to do it in there, or some other gas. So, you know, and it was sealed, so... So you had those, and then the 130s, I hadn't thought about it. So it'd be an interesting thing to run more simulation on it. I really can't address that. Of course, in the jets, you have your own mask, and that's all pretty well regulated. So, I'm not sure.
All right. Next we have from the Center for Aviation, CAPA. This is women airline pilots, a tiny percentage and only growing slowly. So CAPA pulled together some information, some data. CAPA, the Center for Aviation, is a source for market intelligence for aviation and travel industries. And they have some statistics that I know they kind of slice it a little bit differently, I think, than we've seen in the past. But they say the data for the U.S. and the U.K. indicate that just over 4% of airline pilots are women, which tracks pretty close to what we've heard in the past before. CAPA says that in the United States, 7% of all FAA pilot certificates are held by women. So that's a larger number than I think we've seen. But when they look at airline pilots, 4.4% of U.S. airline pilots are women and 4.3% of U.K. airline pilots are women. They note that the share of women pilots, the percentage is growing, but it's growing very, very, very slowly.
Greg, what's enrollment like in the program at the University of Maine, Augusta, men versus women?
You know, that's a good question. I just had about three to four women ask me about that for my freshman class. So we do have some women. It's not anywhere near, but probably 3 to 4%, I guess I would say. As far as enrollment goes, there is some interest in women. I find interest in women both just out of high school and some that have had gone through college and realized that they wanted to fly, had gone out to Dallas and have come back and said, I want to do this. And so we've created programs for them that we can talk about later. But it's very good to see some increasing interest on the part of women. I had the opportunity to fly with several women in the 38, and they worked for me, and I was very impressed with their skills. And it was very few, but they were certainly hard-charging folks and had a different perspective on things.
Yeah, we've talked in the past, I think, with Rob Mark, some of his experiences, and probably with you also, Max T., concerning how oftentimes the problem-solving approach of women who are student pilots is different than for men. And in some cases, women actually have sort of an advantage at that.
Yeah, so I was just going back to an article that I put on my maxruscott.com blog back in 2008. I got asked to present to the 99's regional meeting in San Jose back in 2008 when the AOPA summit was being held here. And so prior to that, I thought I would go ahead and do a survey just to try and figure out what some of the differences were of women student pilots and versus you know, men and those who complete and don't complete. And it was really, I had a great sample because the flying school that I'm associated with has typically around 900 members and hundreds more who've, you know, dropped out over the years. And so I sent surveys out to about 150 women who had started flight training, got a fairly sizable percentage back. What was intriguing to me was that at that time, 6% of total pilots were women, but they were 11% of student pilots, which to me suggested that the dropout rate for flight training was probably higher than men. It looked like, at least from this group of surveys here, that the women on average started training at age 35, so they tended to be a little bit older than the men were, which would probably, you know, contribute to a little bit. And some of the other factors, well, let's just take a look here. Well, the key conclusion I came to was that flight schools really need to provide some extra attention and support to female student pilots, particularly those who are older, since they may find learning to fly a little bit more challenging, and then where possible, they ought to try and match female student pilots with female CFIs.
Interesting. There's a chart in this article that I thought was fascinating. It shows two things. It shows for a number of airlines the number of female pilots for that airline. And, you know, the big guys have the most, as you'd expect, United, followed by Delta, American, Lufthansa. But to me, the more interesting statistic that's also portrayed in this little graphic is the percentage of women who are pilots for that airline. And the top airline is Indigo. And second, Indigo has just under 14% of its pilots are women. And second is Air India, just under 10%. And those two kind of really dominate over most of the others. That was kind of unexpected to me anyway, but some are not so good as a percentage. Southwest doesn't look so great, under 4%. United is a little bit north of 7%, it looks like. Delta is maybe 6%, somewhere in there. Interesting chart, but there is kind of a wide variation from airline to airline, and it doesn't really fit any patterns that I can see.
I was just looking at one other statistical difference in the study here. When the women that I surveyed were asked to rate their instructors, it was statistically significant that for women who didn't complete a certificate, they were significantly less likely to rate their instructor as, quote, well-prepared or, quote, accepting of me and others. So the relationship with the instructor had a, you know, strong correlation with people, with women who chose to discontinue training.
Well, as we record this, a conference just concluded, the ICAO Global Aviation Gender Summit. And I think this was the first time that had been held. That was this year, August 8th through 10th in Cape Town, this being, of course, 2018. I'd be very interested in hearing if any of you listening attended that and have any feedback that you could pass along to us, because I think this is an important topic. And the fact that ICAO is, you know, pulling together an entire summit devoted to this, I think is really, really significant. So if you got some feedback on that, I think that'd be great. Brian sent in an article from an item from Flyer Talk, suing the airlines for better bathroom access. Well, the 1986 Air Carrier Access Act prohibits discrimination based on disability in air travel. And it's got some specific requirements. One is that new twin-aisle airplanes are required to have a wheelchair-accessible lavatory, and single-aisle planes don't have that requirement. Now, the Paralyzed Veterans of America organization has filed a lawsuit against the United States Department of Transportation. And we'll have their press release in the show notes, a link to it that you can take a look at. And it says, in part, on behalf of Paralyzed Veterans of America, Democracy Forward, a different organization, challenged the U.S. Department of Transportation for its unjustified and unlawful delay in issuing rules intended to make airplane restrooms accessible to travelers with disabilities. They also say that last year, Congress directed DOT to move forward in issuing a rule concerning access to restrooms on single-aisle aircraft, despite a 2016 agreement by the members of a DOT-negotiated rulemaking committee to make airplane restrooms accessible. DOT Secretary Elaine Chao ignored the congressional mandate. This is what they say. The department also removed the accessible lavatories rule from the administration's priority agenda. So a lawsuit over this. The Air Carrier Access Act, if you haven't read it, it's kind of interesting. It's we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. If you're interested in this topic, it's worth perusing. But this organization is claiming that the DOT has not followed through with their congressional mandate.
It's getting more and more difficult, and American Airlines has been cited for this a couple of times because the seat pitch is getting tighter and tighter, bathrooms are getting smaller and smaller, and from what I've heard on some 737s, American has redesigned the bathroom so that if you walk inside, you can't even turn around in it. It's that tight.
It's how can we make life more uncomfortable for passengers? But the Air Carrier Access Act, it outlines some prohibition of specific discriminatory practices. Things like an airline cannot require advance notice that a person with a disability is traveling. Airlines cannot require that a person with a disability has to travel with another person, except in certain specific circumstances. There's also items in here concerning the accessibility of facilities. New aircraft with 30 or more seats must have movable aisle armrests on half the aisle seats in the aircraft. The next one is the one we're just talking about. New twin-aisle aircraft must have accessible lavatories. There's other services and accommodations that are mentioned in here. Wheelchairs and other assistive devices have priority over other items for storage in the baggage compartments. Airlines must accept battery-powered wheelchairs. So there's a lot in here. But this lawsuit is apparently dealing specifically with this issue of lavatory accessibility. So I think this will be something that we'll be following in the future. Again, we're speaking with Greg Jolda, Aviation Program Coordinator at University of Maine at Augusta. Greg, again, welcome to the show. Can you tell us a little bit about the program?
Yes, I will. It's a small program still. We started about 5 years ago when I was hired as the Aviation Program Coordinator. At that point, the flight services and the ground instruction services are contracted out to a private public partnership. And the school gets the benefit of having the students matriculated in as university members. And the partnership, of course, gets the flight fees and does the instruction. And the students come in, and it's typically structured so the private first year. And there's a time building in the first summer, second year instrument, and the time building that. Then there's a third year for commercial and the fourth year for instructor pilot. And students typically will come out with about 200 to 200. Flying hours on that order, and the CFII. It's taken a little bit longer for some students to complete, but we've had some complete and some have come back and are instructing now, and it's been a success. So we're looking for partnerships and looking for working on ABI accreditation and the restricted ATP and those sorts of things. Of course, that requires changes in the programs, but that's where we are so far. And I've got 10 students that are signed up for the freshman this year, and that's a pretty good number for us at this point.
And let me point out to those that are listening, we're not talking about the University of Maine. As a Mainer, there are several universities of Maine in Augusta and Fort Kent and Presque Isle and Machias. This is a university, and the University of Maine itself is in Orono. This is the University of Maine, Augusta. So if you're looking for the program, you need to look up University of Maine, Augusta.
Thank you. It is true. And it's, it's a small university. It's a big program. And finance-wise, for what I would consider a smaller university, a smaller piece of it, because it is not the flagship one in the RNO, as mentioned.
Hmm. Yeah, that confused me a little bit at the beginning.
It's easily confusing.
Yeah. So, Greg, why does a university embark on an aviation program? What need is it trying to fill?
You can clearly tell by any of the current publications, the need for pilots and professionally and commercially. That's a basic need that it fulfills. And we find a lot of the students that have come in, and we're hoping to rekindle that in the younger generations of flying. And I've flown with several students that have come in and find them to be pretty sharp and pretty motivated to get into flying. I've had one student who has gone through, and he and I had taken the opportunity to fly the university plane, by the way, a Cessna 172 SP G1000 glass was donated by a benefactor to the university 7 years ago, and we get a chance to fly that, and so he's got some glass time and weather time, and he's flying for Plane Sense now. So, we do see some success in that. So it is clearly the majority of folks want to go into commercial airlining, but some folks like it because they enjoy just the thrill of flying. So we are trying to cater to them also.
Now, Greg, where does most of your class come from? Are they mostly from Maine? Or are they coming from out of state?
We have a few from out of state, and that has started over the past couple of years. But the majority are from Maine, and the majority are from the area. So, yes, it really kind of wonder if how much you can draw from the local population, considering the fees and all. But it's around here. But we do have some out of state folks too. So it's growing that way.
Greg, I'm interested in the curriculum. I have an undergraduate degree in engineering, and so I went to an engineering school and took a lot of engineering courses. But also there were requirements for a lot of non-engineering courses. So my education is obviously more than just engineering. So when a student looks to a university for an aviation program, can you kind of describe the degree to which it's solely focused on aviation and the degree to which it's a broader education?
Yes, I will. And that provide some bit of a contrast between the Embry-Riddles and the North Dakotas and us. We don't have the 60 credits or more of aviation courses that are required to get their completely restricted ATP to 1,000 hours. We're at 1,250 because we offer about 30. But we do have a concentration in business. So the students are not only learning to fly, but they'll have skills in business. There is a backup plan right there with the business. So they'll get a business degree, and they've also got the opportunity to extend their interest in some of the other areas of liberal arts. But it's liberal arts, it's business, and then about 35 to 40 aviation credits. We have flight dynamics, the weather class, a human factors class, flight safety class. It's a capstone class that's done by Tom Pooling, a really, really nice class, and aviation law and homeland security. So there are quite a bit of aviation courses along with the strict flying. So that's what they get: flying plus business and an extension, liberal arts or history or whatever direction the students wanted to go.
Now, besides flying fixed wing, there's other kinds of flying, right? There's a rotary wing, there's unmanned aircraft flying.
We had just started an unmanned component. Unmanned got started as soon as the FAA launched our Part 107. So we cobbled together what we called a commercial drone course, and offered it just sight unseen, and we had about 35 to 40 people, a commercial drone school, actually, we called it, come in and sign up, and it was in class, recorded. It was basically a cut-down private pilot with the emphasis on remote piloting, and we'd gone through the first class, 30, then 40, and classes have varied to the point where we probably trained about 150 to 160 folks, and they've gotten their commercial licenses. Since then, we've added on to that in a design build where we do a design of a fixed wing transmitter, talking about all the componentry there, rotary wing with the same sort of information. And then we're doing a command and control section, photogrammetry class, a photography class, and a large aircraft flying class. We do have access to some pretty good size UAVs. We have procured the closed runway at the Brunswick Landing. So we've got 8,000 feet of drone space there, which really is nice. So we've had a chance to move our facilities down to the Brunswick Landing. That's given us a place to fly. We can't fly in the Augusta area because of the controlled airspace. So we've worked that out. So that component, and we've also generated a certificate in aviation, professional aviation, where we've seen several students come in. Professor Jolda, I've got a bachelor's degree, I've got a master's degree, and I want to go back to flying. I find that's my passion. And it's pretty sad that we have to say, well, you have to get this aviation bachelor's. So we carved out a private instrument commercial sets of classes along with a flight dynamics class, a weather class, and that flight safety class, to comprise about 35 credits. With that, we believe that we can justify that for financial aid because there is a job at the end. We can also probably get that justified for veterans benefits because we hopefully will own the certificates necessary to be able to make that happen. So we're still trying to mold the program to serve the veterans and as a result of previous rule changes and that sort of thing. So it's pretty exciting. It's still on the leading edge, if you will, of this training.
So how much of the program has moved down to Brunswick Landing? And for those listening, Brunswick Landing is a former Brunswick Naval Air Station where we used to have P-3s and C-130s based.
Exactly. And the UAS office has moved down there. We've been teaching our UAS classes out of there, and we didn't have the facilities in our Augusta campus to give us the ability to fly the larger aircraft that we do have, nor was there space for our students to be able to build. So we've got a large amount of lab space there. We've got some hangar space to park some of the larger aircraft. We've got a couple of Albatrosses. I think they're about 11 feet wingspan with multiple sensors for that, and then two for training. I've got some large carbon Zs from Horizon Hobby for a large training. So we'll do a lot of fixed wing training also. And so if someone wants to come in with a commercial and then get their Part 107 and build some time on the UAS. It's pretty attractive jobs for those folks. So that's that part, that's what's down there so far.
Do you have access to flight simulators?
We do have a Redbird FMX, actually, and that decision was made when the program first started, and I was part of that request proposal. Learned a lot about Redbird flight simulators. We had started off looking at a small one, and the president and the provost had decided that we would do this first class, and that was exactly the right way to do it. The FMX gives us now 4 aircraft that we can simulate. We can simulate a Cessna 172 Glass, Cessna 172 Steam, a Beech Duchess, B-76, I think it is, and an Archer. And also with that, we were the testing site for all of the modules that went in this year into the EAA Pilot Proficiency Center, so we'll have access to those. We have Cygnus on there, which snags the GPS of the simulator and sends it out through Bluetooth through your iPad, so you can connect to 4Flight and you can be wherever 4Flight is and wherever you're flying, that shows up. We have Insight that records the flights, and we can also send that data up to Cloud Ahoy. So we've got that. We've got the interface to MindStar Aviation and Pilot Edge. It just is a really sophisticated piece of equipment. Yes, very nice.
What's the connection with the University of Maine, the program with Maine Instrument Flight? Did it start off with you guys working together, or is that something that's new?
No, that's how that happened. It was a public-private partnership between the two for Maine Instrument Flight to develop the flight and ground training for aviation, and the university to supply the necessary courses for the folks to get a bachelor's, and that we find that that's being required now for folks to get into the major airlines, and we all know that the Air Force requires that for anybody that wants to go in. So so that was that's the appeal for both the flight from Maine Instrument Flight and the bachelor's degree for the University of Maine at Augusta.
Greg, you were at Oshkosh this year. What did you find at the event?
I was working in the Pilot Proficiency Center along with the instructor pilots there, and I had a chance to just observe, and I don't even want to tell you that the thought came through my mind, but let me just leave it at that after the first article that we discussed this evening. At the Pilot Proficiency Center run by Joe Brown, they've had a Hartzell propeller. There is a series of 14 LD simulators, and we had instructors staff those for shifts between 9 and 5 an hour apiece for any pilot that wanted to come in and work on his proficiency. We restricted it to them, but we had about 13 what we call VFR scenarios. We had about 13 or 14 instrument scenarios, and new this year was a request by Wally Anderson, actually a technical consultant for EAA home-built aircraft, to put in some don't die scenarios. These are probably the most interesting, and what happened. There was one entitled called Sully, where the pilot in training, who we call the pilot that came in for the training of the simulator, would sit in the left. The instructor would take it to the right. It was a New Haven, Connecticut runway with the cross runways. And we would go through a thorough brief of the aircraft performance, the takeoff roll, how to determine if the engine was performing correctly, what would happen on the ground, what would happen in the air. And then the instructor pilot at sight unseen could just fail the engine, and the pilot in training would, you know, have to respond, and they could see what it was really like. So that one that was really quite exciting. I had a chance to fly that with Wally Anderson and Charlie Precourt. Actually, the NASA astronaut came and visited us because there was such an emphasis on these three don't die scenarios. He came through and we had a chance to fly that.
How did he do?
He did pretty well, and it was very interesting because I found that he had been at Reese Air Force Base after I did. So it was a kind of secret fraternity handshake, you know. As we met, we exchanged things that only folks that had gone through Reese would know. but it was really quite nice. And it got folks' attention on just how that did. And part of that simulation training probably was the heaviest technically based simulation. It was, of course, from Redbird with Charlie Gregoire, from Meister Aviation, Billy Winburn and Stassi Polis, Pilot Edge with Keith Smith and Cloud Ahoy, and all of those technologies integrated together in these sim missions. And it just made a totally professional mission. It was just spectacular to me. And I think that we left students walk out of there with a huge appreciation of what the simulation could do nowadays and just how it could benefit their training. There were contacts for locations that had these simulators and they could continue on that training as they went through. And so I'm hoping to see that grows far more. And that was the hope of this. And I think we achieved that. Over 500 folks, I think, came through at Oshkosh for this 8 days.
Wow.
Max, did you have an opportunity to hang out at the Pilot Proficiency Center this year?
I gave a presentation there on Tuesday, so was presenting.
You did?
Absolutely, presenting on night flying.
Mac, had you flown that scenario that we had?
No, I didn't. I couldn't stay long enough to do that.
The young lady that was managing the instructors had a friend who evidently was lost because of the night hole flying, and that was really a spectacular scenario where you could cover different ways to keep yourself situationally aware, and so much power in those simulations.
You know, the Proficiency Center is really awesome. That was new just a few years ago, and it's grown tremendously, and it's got a great location so that people pretty much stumble right by it as they walk down the midway, if you will, center court of EAA. So it's an awesome facility.
Now, Greg, we mentioned that you were part of the CIRRUS program, the CSIP. Tell us a little bit about how that's sort of organized. I mean, we could ask Max Trescott, but we can check up on him later.
Max will tell you a different story than I will. I will tell you it was extremely humbling because after all of the time in fast movers and to get inside this plane and not even really understand, you know, which button to push, I questioned myself several times, but understanding and really appreciating the value of factory instruction, if you will, you know, being been through the Air Force, both their training and instructed in both of those, I got a great appreciation for all of the students and the kids that, and I'll call them that instructed me, and I learned a lot about their backgrounds and how they learned to fly and where they are. And they're some awesome student, awesome instructors, you know, now that come from not just a few years ago, students through the universities and small ones on the East Coast and North Dakota. And it was quite impressive. I learned a lot. I learned a heck of a lot. And I learned a lot about stabilized approaches. And it gave me a lot of confidence in flying the 22 and the 22 turbo and the 20, which I fly up here in Brunswick.
The question though is, did you have a good time?
I did. And I can't remember what studying so hard was all about. Yes.
Yeah, it's true. Now, did you do it recently in Knoxville or years before in Duluth?
No, I did it. I did it in Knoxville of late. Like, yeah.
Good. Then you got the full Monty.
I did. As a matter of fact, I got to see, well, they were just completing the building with the jet and the fellow that that I had my check ride with had we had some time waiting on a ride. So, and there was a jet parked, I guess, probably for delivery. Heck, I don't know. But he asked me if I'd seen the jet, and I said, I've been inside. And so he kind of gave me the cook's tour of, you know, how it was. And I asked him how it got started and, you know, knowing the difficulty we had with the fingers and the throttles and all to get them going. But I was really quite impressed with that whole area, the delivery area, the delivery hangar and just the total professionalism of that organization. It was really, really quite impressive.
And how many days is CSIP training taking these days? Because I did mine 12 years ago.
It's taking on the order of 5 to 7 days.
Yeah, I was thinking nominally a week. So, yeah, it's amazing. I think people, I occasionally hear flight instructors go, oh, I'm a CFI. I don't need training to teach in a CIRRUS. And it's like, no, actually you do, because there are so many different little nuances that can kill you. Here's an interesting statistic. There have been 18 crashes with CIRRUSes with CFIs on board. Only two of them were CSIPs. The other 16, you know, not trained at the factory, don't know about all these little gotchas. So, yeah, I'm a huge believer in the factory training, and it's gotten only better.
Yes. I was impressed. Well, of course, the Air Force when we had a problem, it was hand grips raise. And so when you had the serious problem, you pull the chute. So it was an easy move for me to go to that. And I found that to be quite interesting, and how all of that works. So we get a chance to do that in the simulator, and they have a great hot bench there. And you're right, Max. The only thing that I know, Max, is that the more I know I don't know in that airplane. It's just incredible. But I had a chance to fly a student today, and I was commenting on that earlier in the weather. And sometimes students don't get a lot of chance to get into the weather, you know, for one reason or other. But I was able to pick him up in 500 to 600 foot seaglings today in the fog, Portland, and back up into Brunswick. And he went from the Roundel to the Cirrus and just had an absolute blast. But it was his first opportunity to see what breaking out and how the ILS has to be right on to be able to see where you're going. So it was really quite a thing, and it's nice to be able to fly that aircraft and know that and have full confidence in all of the systems.
Yeah, it's great having a capable aircraft when you're in poor weather. I think the big challenge with the Cirrus is if you're flying many, many model years. So they started shipping in 99. You've got 19 years worth of aircraft, and every model year has got differences. So it's like, ugh, keeping up with, hey, it works this way in that airplane and that way in that one. It's like, whoa, that's a major effort.
It is. The 20 is, I don't know, about eight or nine years old. It's a generation 3. And so I was flying, I flew in Knoxville, I flew a generation, the newest generation. It had 15 hours. I'm still on mineral oil. So, you think, holy cow, where do you get a chance to fly a brand new airplane like this? But so it was, and that had all of the latest features. And I flew down to Oshkosh with Cliff Allen, who's the rep out here in the East Coast, and he's got a new one, and he's even got more things than his because he gets a new one every 6 months. So it's really amazing. But still, basically, it's nice to know that you can get into that plane and things sort of work the same way. And from the 20 to the 22T.
One question I have about this kind of factory training is the CSIP program, is that only for flight instructors, or is it also for just a pilot that just wants to improve his or her own personal proficiency without any intent of training others?
Be nice if they had the bandwidth to do that. It's tough enough to get in there as an instructor. So no, they don't have the luxury of teaching that to anybody but an instructor who's going to really kind of plug into the Cirrus network in some way. So no, it's not something where you're just going to go, oh, I'd like to go spend a week at Knoxville.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not going to bring you in for that.
Yeah, I think you're expected to learn the plane. You're expected to know all the instrument procedures and how to brief approaches and all the things that come with being a CFII is what I understand.
What about other airplane manufacturers? Are there similar programs?
Boy, for GA aircraft in this class, I would say nothing comparable anymore. Cessna used to have a program that ran, I think it was initially 5 days. They cut it down to 3 days. I don't know what they're doing now. So no, I would say this is probably the gold standard for piston, four to six place aircraft.
All right. Well, Greg, getting back to University of Maine at Augusta, are there any developments coming with the aviation program? Anything that you'd like to tell our listeners? And along the way, give us some links where we can learn more about the program online.
We're looking to always improve. I would like to get the simulator more embedded into the program, and we're looking to advertise that more for use both by students and by the flying public. We're finding the folks that have an interest in the simulator are starting to come. That is a non-student, non-university students, and an instructor that wants to give a student some extra time, that's available too. So that's I think a big emphasis at this point is to work on the simulation and tout the fact that we do have these EAA Pilot Proficiency Center modules, and we've got the expansion screens. It really is a great training device, and that's where we are so far. And we're looking to grow as we always did, and the ABI accreditation and the restricted ATP to 1250.
The question I had along those lines too is I'm wondering. I read in Flying Magazine recently that there's not just a shortage of fixed wing pilots, but there's going to be a shortage of helicopter pilots. Has the UMaine Augusta program looked at all into adding rotary wing at some point?
Oh, We had not, but I have occasion. There was a Rotary Wing Corporation that had approached the SMCC, South Maine Community College folks, I believe it was, out at Brunswick, and that didn't go. It's very difficult to get folks. It's a far more expensive program, is from what I understand, and folks that have tried to do that just could not bring up the numbers at smaller universities. So we have not looked at that at the Rotary Wing. We do go the other way, though. We do have folks that have come in from the Army Rotary and got them fixed, and then they're a CFII, you know, and that's an attractive move.
And Greg, where can people go online to learn more about the program?
UMA.edu/aviation.
All right, very good. Thanks for spending some time with us and our listeners, Greg.
I'm honored, Max. Thank you very much for the opportunity to do it.
Well, I think you may be aware of the recent crash in Switzerland of the Ju-52. And our Airplane Geeks reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari, actually did a fair amount of research into this, which I have to fall on my sword and say that he sent us a week ago, but somehow, I don't know. I think I fat-fingered deleted it or something and never saw it until just the other day. So we're a week late on that. Apologies to Launchpad Merzari. But like I said, he did a lot of research on this and has a short report. And he also provided a real treasure trove of links to sites related to this, some videos and some other information. So let's listen to Launchpad Merzari.
Translated from SRF, the Swiss National Television Network, a historic Ju-52 on a sightseeing tour crashed in the Swiss Alps on Saturday. The Ju-152 was operated by JU Air of Switzerland, was found at 8,330 feet near Pitzsigen in the remote rugged mountains of eastern Switzerland. The crash can only be accessed by helicopters. All 17 passengers and three crew were killed in the crash. The two pilots were former airline pilots of Swiss Air, Swiss, and Edelweiss Airlines, and military pilots of the Swiss Air Force. Both were flight captains, ages 62 and 63 years old, and have served as scheduled and military pilots for over 30 years. Both captains had several hundred hours of Ju-52 PIC time. The flight attendant also had 40 years of professional experience. Based on the situation at the crash site, we can say that the aircraft hit the ground almost vertically at a relatively high speed, said Daniel Knitsch, head of the Aviation Swiss Transportation Safety Investigation Board, STSB. Note, as of this recording, the STSB has not updated their webpage with preliminary reports. What we can rule out at this point is a mid-air collision before the crash, either with another aircraft or with some obstacle such as a cable, said Mr. Knitsch. There was no indication of any external interference with the flight, he added. The aircraft does not appear to have suffered any major problems before impact. The cause of the accident is unclear, but the investigators say they could not rule out a link to the current heat wave in Europe. While living in Germany, I have seen many of these Ju-52s at the European air shows. They are a staple. JU Air, based in Dubendorf, Switzerland, has run a fleet of Ju-52 aircraft since 1983 for sightseeing tours across Europe. This is the first accident for the company. Many of our listeners have seen this aircraft, as it was the one that flew into AirVenture Oshkosh in 2012 and was the silver aircraft used in the movie Valkyrie. See the show notes. The aircraft, Hotel Bravo, Hotel Oscar Tango, was built in 1939 and acquired from the Swiss Luftwaffe in 1983 by JU Air. It is serviced every 35 hours of flying time and is believed to be in good condition after its most recent service at the end of July. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Merzari.
Oh, thanks for that, Launchpad. As I mentioned, we have some links. One of the interesting links is something called the Internet Movie Plane Database, IMPDB. Now, I hadn't been aware of this before. I don't know how I missed this, but they say that they're dedicated to identifying aircraft throughout movies, television, and video games. So that's it's a fairly interesting resource. Launchpad's got some video from that 2008 Tom Cruise movie, Valkyrie, and a number of other links, the Swiss Transportation Safety Investigation Board, and some other technical data. So thanks to Launchpad for doing all that work. And if you're interested in learning more about, well, about the crash, but also about the aircraft itself and how it's been used in movies and that sort of thing, check out the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/516.
And would you like photographs of her?
Yes. Do you have some, David?
Yeah, I was at Oshkosh in 2012, and I took lots of pictures of one of my all-time favorite airplanes.
Send them along, David. We'll put them in the show notes.
Okay.
All right. The Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In. Micah, where was that?
Well, it was a fabulous, fabulous experience that took place just a few weeks ago in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. And, you know, I think I describe it best in the little piece that I sent in. So maybe we should just play that. That'll give you a good idea. So our helicopter pilot friend and regular listener, Ernie Eaton, first told me about the annual Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Well, wait, let me give credit where credit is due. Ernie's not just a helicopter pilot. He has his fixed wing certificate, too, and recently helped ferry his son's aircraft from Maine to Seattle. But that's another story for another time. Anyway, Ernie was kind enough to send me a note reminding me of the Spurwink Farm Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In that was held on 8 July this year. It's an annual event sponsored by the Experimental Aircraft Association, EAA Chapter 141, based in Lymington, Maine. This fly-in has been going on for over 20 years and is held on a beautiful, privately owned grass strip that's part of a sprawling saltwater farm in Cape Elizabeth that overlooks the beaches where the Spurwink River empties into the Atlantic Ocean. It's an absolutely beautiful location. The fly-in takes place each year on the second Sunday in July, and this year was the largest ever, with over 73 aircraft in attendance. I must say, I don't think I've ever seen so many vintage tail draggers in operation ever before in my life. The whole program is open to the public, and the pancakes are terrific, as is the sausage and the all-natural, real Maine-made maple syrup. None of the brown-colored sugar water for me, please. Mark your calendars for next year, when it happens to fall on Bastille Day. That's 14 July for those of you who aren't sure. I've got to say, it was a fabulous experience to attend this year's fly-in, and I have to thank EAA Chapter 141 for doing such a great job and making me and everyone else in attendance feel so welcome. I was able to conduct a couple of interviews with a few folks while there. The quality of the recordings were at most fair, but if Miracle Max Flight works his magic into them, my guess is he may be able to hide much of my technical ineptitude. The interviews include Bunk Chase, the organizers of this year's fly-in and past president of EAA Chapter 141, Dave DeVries, who came to the fly-in in a beautiful 1935 Kinner Sportwing, the only one left in the world. He also happens to be president of the New Hampshire Pilots Association. We spoke with the FAA inspector and fly-in air boss, Jonathan Good, Ed Thompson, who was finishing up a build of a Super Cub replica, and Tim Bickford, who fully restored a gorgeous 1928 Travelair 4000, an aircraft designed by Stearman, Cessna, and Beech. No, not the companies, the men themselves. Now one more thing before we go on to some of the interviews. In the spirit of full disclosure, I interviewed Sean Moody, who arrived at the fly-in in his light sport Sea Ray Classic. In the crowded hangar in which breakfast was held, there was an empty seat across from me, and Sean took it. Now, he happens to be the Republican candidate for governor of the state of Maine, but he wasn't there to campaign. He was attending, like any other pilot and EAA member, to see airplanes, to talk some hangar talk, and enjoy the fly-in. My interview with Sean was conducted from that perspective. As an independent thinker and registered as an unenrolled voter, I'm not endorsing any candidate nor party affiliation, and neither are the airplane geeks. Had Sean's opposition flown in that day, Democratic candidate for governor Janet Mills, I would have been equally delighted to have interviewed her as well. So with that little bit of clarification, let's go to the interviews.
All right, we have, I think, time for a couple of these, Micah. Where shall we start?
Well, being that I did the disclosure about Sean Moody, why don't we just start with him right there? So if anybody listens another time, we won't get that in the way. This is your main man, Micah, coming to you live from the Spurwink Pancake Breakfast and Fly-In that happens every year on the second Sunday in July here at Spurwink Farm in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. I'm here talking with Sean Moody, and Sean Moody is a pilot, a great guy, and also happens to be a candidate for governor. But let's talk to him a little bit about being a pilot. Sean, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Micah. It's great to be here. Johnny and I have been coming out here for years, and just look at the crowd. It's good. These are good Mainers right here, good people, you know, and they know that life's not a spectator sport. They want to get out there and fly and do things and experience Maine from a different perspective. And you can see things in around Maine that you just can't see from driving around, you know, flying up the coast or some of the remote ponds and areas up through northern and central Maine. It's just beautiful.
People who haven't seen Maine don't understand that the coast is really different than a lot of other places, with a really rocky coast and places where grass grow right into the ocean, and you can't see that anywhere better than from flying in an aircraft along the coast. Now, you've been flying for a while. What are you flying? How did you get into aviation?
Wow. Yeah, it's been, it's coming up on, I think, 30 years, isn't it, Johnny? I got my flying buddy right beside me here, Johnny Pompeo. I think it's been 30 years? 30 years in August. Will be a reunion. Yeah, the reason I get into flying is interesting is Al Caruso of Mac Jets, you know, Alan Caruso, was formerly Maine Aviation. I worked on his drag car. I was his pit crew when I was about 15 or 16 years old. I worked for his brother, Ronnie Caruso, at Ron's Corvette Center. And when we couldn't make the race for whatever reason, we'd drive into Portland, jump in a Cessna, and fly up to the dragway because there's a strip right beside Oxford Plains Dragway. So that's, he'd let me take the controls and, you know, that hooked me right there, 15, 16 years old. I loved it.
You know, we ought to let our listeners know, actually, that you're a car guy to begin with, and you actually started working on cars and actually own and run with your employees a chain of collision centers that's one of the biggest chains and, from my perspective, one of the best chains in Maine.
Wow, thanks. One thing's unique about our organization is 34% of it's owned by the co-workers. It's called an ESOP, Employee Stock Ownership Plan. So they, you know, they own stock of the company, so it's more than a job to them, you know, just like it's their co-worker owners.
Now, what do you fly in? How often do you get a chance to get up in the air?
Well, I'm pretty rusty right now. been running hard for governor. But typically we put in probably 40, 50 hours, 60 hours, you know, during the summer. So we fly recreationally. Johnny flies more than that. It's his plane. He's a good friend of mine. He lets me fly it whenever I want, which is great. And it's like anything, you know, you want to stay proficient. Flying's not something that you have to take lightly.
Now, which aircraft is yours? Which one did you fly in on today?
It's a light sport aircraft. It's called a Sea Ray. It's an amphibious. It's like a miniature lake for people that aren't that familiar with airplanes. It lands on water or land. The wheels go up, and you land basically on the fuselage. So it doesn't have pontoons, which floats, you know, which most people would relate to with a float plane. You land basically on the fuselage itself. It's a thrill, you know, when you come in 65, 70 miles an hour down on the water to land. It's quite a thrill. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I got a picture of it, and it's beautiful. It's more like a flying boat than it is a pontoon aircraft. And so let me ask you, it's a light sport aircraft. Do you hold just your light sport, or do you have a regular pilot's license as well?
Yeah, no, I got my private pilot's license back in, I think, the early 90s. From Vic LaRanger, who was really, you know, a legend in the aviation world, flying out of Biddeford. Got my pilot's license. I actually started flying ultralights. I had about a half hour lesson before I soloed. I wouldn't recommend that for your listeners out there, but seat of the pants, you know, just a little Vector. Had a snowmobile engine on it. We flew that for years. My wife was like, you know, you probably ought to go learn how to fly if you're going to stick with it. So she talked me into going in and taking my written and studying for my written exam, and Vic was my instructor. Incredible. He had a former military pilot. He had a rating for helicopter, his C rating, tail dragger rating. I mean, that guy was incredible. I can remember when I took my final test, we went out over the ocean, day like today. I'll never forget it. And we were going in for our final landing. He shut the motor off, okay? He said, pull the nose up, pull the nose up. I kept pulling up. Don't stall. He said, pull the nose up. And I did, and that prop stopped. And we went in, did a dead stick landing to benefit. And I was right in my throat. I said, geez, Vec, I said, you do that with every pilot? He goes, no. He says, but you strike me as a guy that might go on and get you a commercial or something. I just wanted to see how you held up under pressure.
That's great, Sean. Sean, we were talking just a little bit earlier about how, you know, there's not quite as many aircraft around and not many people interested in piloting so much. Now, we got a great crew of CAP kids around here today, and they're obviously into it. And down at the Udvar-Hazy Center a few weeks ago, I interviewed some wonderful Civil Air Patrol cadets. How do you think we can get kids interested in aviation again?
Yeah, you know what? We were just talking about that with these fellows over here. And they've done a great job down at Biddeford. They say they do some open houses. You know, they really publicize it in the local community. It's grassroots. It's word of mouth. It really is. I think getting people involved, you really got to reach out. They just won't do it on their own. So I think we need to keep the local flying clubs active and take some of that money and put it into advertising, outreach, because it's a wonderful hobby, you know, recreation that you can have and something you could do your entire life. It has an expense related to it and time related to it, but the thrill that you get out of it's incredible.
There's nothing like it. Sean, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today, and welcome to the Airplane Geeks, and good luck with the campaign.
Thank you, Micah. Appreciate it.
All right. Micah, I have sort of the impression that Maine is in some ways kind of a little bit like Alaska, from the standpoint that there are a lot of places in Maine that the best way to get there is to fly in. Is that kind of a fair assessment?
Well, Max, you would probably know that better than many other people listening. You've been to Igor Sikorsky's fly-in up there in the Great Woods of Maine, where you really can't – you drove in, and it wasn't an easy drive, as I recall. But, yeah, there's some – Maine is very much like Alaska in that way, and simply beautiful up along the coast. And there are a lot of places you can't get any place but in an aircraft or in specifically, you know, a float plane. And there's a lot of wonderful lakes to land in and ponds. And if you one of the photos that I have, you have to realize the atmosphere that was taking place at this particular fly-in, because it's on this grass strip on this beautiful farm, but it's what's known up here in Maine as a saltwater farm. It goes right up to the edge of the sea. And hopefully you'll have time to post a picture in the show notes of me next to Vans RV-12. And I only took that picture because it shows you exactly what you're looking at. Right on this grass strip and right behind me is the ocean and the Spurwink River. It's just gorgeous.
All right. What should we do next?
Well, you know, as I was standing there in front of the hangar watching planes take off and land, and it was just an amazing sight to see this on this grass strip and all these beautiful aircraft and old tear draggers. There was this gentleman there who was just watching along with me, and I said hello and asked him what he was doing there. Turned out he's an old-time pilot and is building in his basement, well, not in his basement, in his garage, a Super Cub replica. So let's talk to Ed Thompson. This is your main man, Micah, coming to you from the Spurwink Farms annual fly-in here this beautiful July day in Pancake Breakfast. And we're talking with Ed Thompson, who's a pilot, and you're working on a restoration of a replica of a Super Cub. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and how long you've been working on it?
Okay, I bought the plans from a company called Light Miniature Aircraft, and I've been working on it for 10 years now. It's all made of wood. The frame is all Douglas fir with marine plywood on the sides. And I'm going to use a Volkswagen engine. I have a 85-horse Volkswagen engine with a reduction gear and a wood propeller. And it's all in yellow, almost ready to hang the engine. I've got to finish the wiring and plumb in the gas lines. And then it'll be ready to hang the engine on it and then build a cowling around it. And hopefully before fall comes, we're going to fly it.
Well, you just showed me a picture of it, and it looks absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's just gorgeous. But it sounds like if you've been building this from scratch as a replica of it, you've got to be a woodworker, an electrical engineer, a mechanic and technical engine expert, and a plumber and everything. How did you develop the time and the skills and the desire to do all this kind of work?
Well, it's just do a lot of reading. In fact, I've always joked with my daughter and my wife both have master's degrees in education, and I tell them, this is my master's degree. I've had to learn all this electronics and wood and everything else, and so this is my master's degree.
That's great. Now, you've been flying since you were 40 years old. You finally got the bug, and what drove you to that? What made you finally decide that you needed to get your pilot's license?
Well, it was something I'd always wanted to since I was a teenager. And when I turned 40, I said, Don, I'm not getting any younger. This is the year I'm going to do it. And I did. I over the year, when I was 40, I got my license. And that was back in 88. And then I had a period where I didn't fly because money was tight with kids growing up and everything. And then I got back into it. And I found my 172, and I only paid $20,000 for my 172.
That's an incredible bargain. Wow.
Well, the engine was almost run out. I flew it for about 150 hours after that, and then it was time to have the engine rebuilt, and that cost almost $14,000. But and then I had the plane painted in 2008, but we've had a wonderful time. My wife and I have been all over the country in our 172. We even flew all the way out to the Grand Canyon and flew over the Grand Canyon in it.
That sounds wonderful, all the way from Maine out to the Grand Canyon. What kind of avionics do you have in it?
Just basic. And I just flew with my handheld GPS, and we've just flown all over the country in it.
Stick and rudder is the way to go, there's no doubt about it.
And I can't wait to get my Super Cub done, and it's going to be slow. It's going to cruise at 85, but it's going to be stick and rudder, low and slow. Beautiful.
Now, what's your background with a tail dragger? Because the 172's got a nose wheel, and your Super Cub is a tail dragger.
I've done a little flying. I went down to Hampton and got my tail wheel endorsement, and I've just flown a little bit of tail wheel. I need some more practice before I start testing my plane.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on the Airplane Geeks, and best of luck with the Super Cub, and I hope that next year at this time I'll get to see you land it.
Alrighty, well, thank you very much.
Wow, seems like it was a really, really nice event, Micah. Thanks for recording some of those conversations. We have some more to go, and we'll be playing those in future episodes, so hopefully we'll get through them relatively quickly, Micah, but thanks for bringing us those.
It was so much fun, and I got to thank EAA Chapter 141 again for holding it and having me along there, and I just recently found out they have another event taking place in Lymington, Maine in October, and hopefully I'll go there too and bring you some more interviews.
All right. One of the things that happens in our Slack listener team is our friend Isaac tends to put together a list of, what does he call them, like this week in aviation kinds of items. And there was one of them recently, Micah, that was kind of interesting.
Well, this one I just had to put in last minute because when I saw it, Isaac posted it just today. I said, well, we've got to celebrate this. This week is the anniversary of the first flight from back in 1954 of the Lockheed C-130 Hercules. And I know it's one of David's favorites. It's one of my favorites. And being that the Hercules and I celebrate a birthday around the same time of year, although the Hercules is still a few years older than me, we're both still kicking.
All right. And a little bit of what's up with the geeks. Max Trescott, anything new in your world?
Oh, busy as always. So there was something that happened a little unusual this past weekend. I was out flying my RC aircraft. I'm going to start it that way, because if I started by saying I had my first mid-air collision, people might get a little concerned. But no, this wasn't an RC aircraft. And for folks who don't fly RC, if you're a pilot, man, it's tougher than it looks, especially if you're getting on up in years there. I think for folks that grew up in the video game generation, yeah, it's probably different. If you start flying when you're in your teens and your 20s, it's different. But I started flying in my my late 50s about 4 years ago. And yeah, it's tough. But I was flying my favorite SR-22, which my wife gave me for Christmas. And I hadn't gotten around to getting it all assembled until just a few weeks ago. So it had about 7 or 8 flights on it. And I was flying away and boom, it hit another airplane. And they both came tumbling down. And I was just crestfallen. You know, it was my favorite airplane. It was beautiful. It was spectacular. And then, boom, you know, in just a moment, we had a foam shower. You know, all kinds of foam airplanes falling down from the sky. But
how big is this thing?
Oh, gosh. I think it's a 1.5-meter wingspan, as I recall. Four-plus.
Pretty good size.
Yeah, 4.5 feet, something like that. So, yeah, it's big enough that it doesn't just go with the back seat. I've got to make some room in the hatchback to get that in, unlike all the other things that I fly.
Were you able to recover the airworthiness certificate? Will she fly again?
Well, I think she will fly again. I mean, that's the nice thing about foam is that, repairs are a little bit easier than they would be for a real Cirrus. So that's good. And, parts are less expensive than they are for a real Cirrus as well. But I kind of reflected on it afterwards. And I thought, I actually contributed to this. The other gentleman said, I thought my plane was higher than yours. And I was thinking, gee, I didn't see your airplane until after I had the boom. And then I realized a gentleman had come up, started talking with me. And, I'm not so good at this that I usually stand there casually chatting with people while I'm flying. I like to really just, concentrate, do it by myself, no distractions, nobody standing next to me yakking. And I realized, darn it all, I let him distract me. I should have kind of told him, hey, let's talk after I'm done here. I'm kind of busy. And that distracted me. And so I was certainly flying the airplane okay, but I wasn't looking ahead to see what was in front of it. So, that was kind of my bad. But I think that that's kind of an important thing for all pilots. I think distractions are one of the leading causes of all accidents. And if I look back at this, I think I contributed to the demise of my own Cirrus by just being distracted. So it was a good lesson in there. Fortunately, a less expensive lesson than if it were in a real airplane.
Yes, for sure. All right. Micah, you got anything interesting going on?
Well, I was able to, as I mentioned, I just recently had a birthday, celebrated it last week, and for the celebration, my friend took me on a trip up to Bath, Maine, where I got to go by Bath Ironworks and got to see the USS Michael Mansour, the second ship in the Zumwalt class of guided missile destroyers. It's amazing. It's a stealth ship. It looks more like a Buck Rogers rocket than it looks like, or an F-117 than it does a destroyer. And it was neat because also right next to it was the latest of the Arleigh Burke class destroyers, the USS Thomas Hudner. So you can really see what the old and the new looks like. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, for whatever reason, the Mansour is the second of what's going to be 3 ships. And the third is going to be the USS Lyndon Johnson, and that's being built right now. And I'm hoping to be able to get a tour of one of them sooner or later. I got to find a friend at Bath Ironworks.
All right, and you also found a couple of interesting television programs.
Well, yeah, the Smithsonian Channel. I happen to be turning it on, and there's a series that's been on for a while, but the new season of Air Warriors just started. And you can find some of those online, and I guess we'll post those in the show notes, the links to it. And they're kind of fun. There's also another show called Mighty Planes, and I kind of enjoy them. It reminds me of the old Discovery Wings channel because those shows aren't so sensationalized. Sometimes they over-dramatize some things of it, but it's a history of the aircraft, typically, and how they were built and where they come from and what their purpose is. So they're really a lot of fun, and I highly recommend them if you get the Smithsonian Channel or can find some of the old ones online.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap up this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guests, Greg Jolda. He's the Aviation Program Coordinator at the University of Maine at Augusta. And that, of course, is at uma.edu/aviation. You can find us on our homepage at airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like to send us an email, you can reach us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. And David Vanderhoof, we will start with you.
Well, you can find me drowning in the middle of thunderstorms here in Pennsylvania as the power's gone off a couple of times during this recording. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. And you can find me talking to that guy, Max Flight, about UAVs and drones on Friday mornings on the UAVDigest.com.
Great. Ian Max Prescott, how about you?
Well, I would say that anybody who is interested in a Cirrus, whether they're interested in buying one or training one, give me a call because I do help folks who are thinking about buying a new one. Let's see. And then online, you can always find me at aviationnewstalk.com. Just click on contact. And if you're out here in the San Francisco Bay Area, come on by and say hello. I teach at the Palo Alto Airport, usually in the air 5-6 days a week.
All right. And Micah, where do we find more Micah?
Well, this week, actually, I might have a small piece appearing on Jetwine, of all places, if Rob Mark posts it as he said he would. So we'll see if that happens sometime soon. But you can always get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at MaineFly. That's Maine like the state, M-A-I-N-E, fly. And you can also reach me at Micah, M-I-C-A-H, Micah at airplanegeeks.com.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me in LinkedIn. David said at the UAVDigest.com and also with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience at PaxXPodcast.com. Our outro music is by Bruno Massone. Find more of his compositions at BrunoMassone.com. And please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Great speaking with you.
And thanks for listening.